Meeting will come to order. We're going to start today with the presentation on limited market value. Get some background on that. And who would like to go first, Ms. Baker?
Mr. Chair, I think I'm going to go first. For the record, my name is Karen Baker, and Steve Hines and I have been asked just to give a 10-minute or so kind of overview of kind of the history of limited market value, and then the commissioner is going to follow with a discussion of some work that they've done on limited market value and data. In your folder, you should have two things. One is an old information brief. I say old. It was 1998 that Steve and I did on the history of limited market value. And we didn't have time or didn't get a chance to update it at all. So what we did is just kind of hand wrote kind of at the bottom a couple or the changes that have occurred since 1998, since that brief was prepared. And then in addition, there's also a short subject which Steve and I put together, which we did, which also does a quick overview of limited market value. It's the TAN sheet. So you should have those too. Mostly what I want to do is just kind of concentrate on the center. I think yesterday we did talk a little bit in committee. The question was asked about the tax court, and so I will mention a little bit about that court case just in passing. But if you look at the two-page history on the inside of it, you'll see that limited market value was first put in effect in 1973. And in 1973, it only had, it had residential ag, temporary seasonal rec, which is our lakeshore cabin property. And it had 5% was the limit. It also had another provision, which was only in effect for 1 year, and that was that if a property was sold, then the property jumped up to market value. That was put in the very first year of its enactment. Then you can see as we go down that in 1974, the change that was really made to it was that it began to be applied to all owners, and that was that if property sold, the value stayed with the property. It didn't go with the owner, and so that was so it really stayed with the property. Then in 1975, a fairly major change was made, and that was it picked up all property, became subject to limited market value. And for the next several years until the legislature abolished it, it did cover all property. For most of those years, you can see that the limit was 10% of the previous year's assessment, and it was one-fourth of the increase, whichever was greater, and we can talk a little bit more about that equation in a few minutes. Then in 1979, the limit was abolished, and it was done over a kind of a phase-out or a period of 2 years. And that was at the time period when the tax court in January of 79 held LMV unconstitutional, and partially kind of in response to that tax court decision, the LMV or the legislature eliminated LMV by phasing it out over this two-year period. And although in September of 1980 the Supreme Court did uphold the constitutionality of the law, which reversed the tax court decision, the legislature had already repealed the provisions. So Supreme Court didn't have really any effect. But Then we didn't have any LMV provisions at all until in 1993, when they came back in for the, and these are assessment years, so this would be taxes payable in 1994 was the first year. And then it was the same basic classes that we have now, the residential, the ag, and the seasonal rec. And it had the 10% of the previous year's assessment and the one-third of increase, whichever was greater. And at that point, it was put in as a temporary, and you can see in the special provisions that it was planned to be to expire in 1998, and then in 1994, that expiration date was changed to 1997. And I can't remember the rationalization for that. Then in 1997 and 98, again we had that same limitation of 10% and the 1/4 of, or I should say, you'll notice in the limit provisions that there was some change, that although the 10% stayed pretty constant, the 1/3 and the 1/4, there was different kind of catch-up provisions that were used. And we had it expiring in 2001. Then in the, through the 1999 through the 2001, the main thing that was changed is the timberland was added in 2001, and the 10% dropped to an 8.5%, and it was dropped down to a 15% of the increase in value, whichever is greater. And then the expiration date was still set for the 2001 assessment. And then we now have the same properties in effect, except we have a phase-out, which the phase-out is going to be through assessment year 2006. So beginning in pay 2007, LMV will be eliminated.
Ms. Baker, do you know what the rationale was, or do you recall, for not including all property in the 93?
I'm sorry.
The rationale for changing, excluding some property from limited market value in 1993. Do you know, was there any discussion about it, or did it just one of those things that happened?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure of the rationale. I would guess some of it might be that the increase in the valuations of the property, you know, of commercial industrial, for instance, might not even have been 10%, so I'm not sure if it had anything to do with that.
Do you remember at all that why we didn't sell property, or was it just...
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Steve Hines from House Research. I don't recall a specific rationale, but of course with that big of a time gap between the last time it was imposed, it almost was like creating a new program from scratch as opposed to dropping the other classes. Yeah. It was starting it up, and the pressure was in the, seemed like it was especially in the seasonal recreational, but it was, you know, there's always been some debate about whether it made sense on income producing property to put this provision in, and I think it was, the case was made for the other classes, and so far hadn't been made.
Okay, thank you.
No.
I guess now maybe if I could turn your attention to the short subject, which is the tan sheet of the two-pager. The bottom of that first page is the schedule that we're now under for how the program is phasing out. And you'll see that currently, I guess, we're in, our thoughts are in terms of assessment year 2005, payable 2006. That will be next year. Next year's taxes payable, this year's assessment year, and under this, the phase out this year, the increase is either 15% of the previous year or 33% of the amount of untaxed value in total. And you can see that column two, that's the percentage that's really been increasing quite a bit each year. From, you can see kind of the pattern. The phase out was in 2003 to pick up 20%. That was like 1/5 of what was still out there. Then the next year 1/4. The next year 1/3. 2006 50% or half. That was kind of the idea, is to pull the rest of that value back into the tax base in that period of time. But there's we always had to work a column one, column two kind of thing to prevent very small increases from not being picked up because of the because they were only 33%. At any rate, that's the schedule that we've been under now since the 2001 tax bill. And as you can see now, it will expire. The last year there will be LMV would be assessment year 2006, pay 2007. The next page on the top just shows a sample calculation of how it actually works for a property. And I don't think I'll spend time with that, but you could look at that. And if there's questions, we take them. Then in the middle of the page there, we see a table of how much under this most recently enacted limited market value program, how much there has been each year. And the graph down below shows it perhaps easier that the amount of value excluded from the tax base really was fairly small at the beginning and then really rose steeply in 2001, 2002, 03, 04. And then this year, 2005, was the first year that it really ratcheted back quite a bit. You can see in the table the amount went from $34.9 billion to $27 billion. And as a percentage of the value of excluded base, it was from about 11% to 7.5%, really quite a dramatic reduction. And that's, I think, due to the fact that the catch-up provision has now become so important. Let's see, so for pay 2005, assessment year 2004, picking up 25% of the difference really brought a lot of that tax base back into the taxable tax base. And just on a class basis, it was really dramatic when you look at homesteads. The homestead amount of LMV was about $21 billion in pay 04. It's only $11 billion in pay 05. So fully half of the amount of excluded value in homesteads came back in pay 05. For seasonal rec, the amount continued to increase from 04 to 05. Ag was fairly constant. Just a very brief break on it. But the dramatic thing was this residential homestead. So much of it did come into taxable tax capacity now in pay 2005.
Mr. Hines, what are some of the reasons that you have this much value that you're trying to recapture or unassessed across the state? If 10% was allowed, I mean, if they could go up 10% before they'd be excluding market value each year, and the market probably, you know, there's some instances when it went up faster than that, but if it was generally in that range, I mean, 10% is quite a bit. Why would we have such a huge difference between what's assessed and what's excluded?
Mr. Chairman, let's see, if you're asking about the big, how much is assessed and how much is excluded, I think it, in the years 2003, 2004 payable, it just reflects the fact that home values particularly, and seasonal rec, and ag, really all three of them were really going up by, quite high percentage increase, even relative to the 15 and 12% limits. They were growing that fast that it really helped. It did really take a lot of the tax base off the rolls. And now the home values the value growth has tapered down somewhat, and these catch-up provisions combined with the 15 have brought a lot of it back in just in this last year.
Well, I understand what you're saying. Oh, Ms. Baker.
Mr. Chair, I think also kind of what you're asking is when the assessors are out valuing property, there's no question that they cannot value a piece of property and view a piece of property every year. In fact, the change was made just a couple years ago to change from the 4 years to the 5 years so that they only had to view the property every fifth year. And I think some assessors, and depending on where they are and what kind of systems they have and, you know, computer systems, and some are doing things a lot more by hand than others, as to whether or not they really do increase property every year as the market's going up, or whether or not they really put large increases on in 1 year, even though that 40% increase they're putting on this year really should have been 20% last year and 10% the year before that and 10% the year before that. And that's one of the reasons why limited market value came into play, I think, is because some of these increases were very, very large, and people said, you know, we can't take this 50% and 75% increase from 1 year to the next, and why is this happening? So I think that that's one of the reasons why these large values come into play, and you know, the LMV kind of moves it over and phases it in over a period of time, even though you can argue that over the last couple of years, those people probably should have had that 10% or 15 or 20, you know, for the past 2-3 years. But I think it's a partly an administrative kind of issue as well.
So, Ms. Baker, what you're saying is that the assessment process isn't perfect? And that the assessors are frequently not current with values? Is that...
Mr. Chair, I don't know if I would go quite so far. I mean, I think the assessors try very hard to keep as current as they can. But I think there is a lot of demands on them, and I think that given the different counties, the different systems, the different, you know, technologies that they have, I think it's very hard for them to always keep as current as they'd like to. And I think some of these kind of things happen, and they don't always get a chance to increase values, you know, probably like they should on an annual type basis. And, you know, I think some of the assessors probably would like to respond and could respond a lot better than what, you know, than what I am telling you as to what some of their problems really are in valuing as many parcels as they have given with staff and everything there.
And I'm not suggesting the assessors aren't working hard, and we're going to give them an opportunity, I think, in the next meeting to talk about that a little bit. But Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Chair Vandeveer. And actually, this is a question for you, or maybe Representative Broad. You're probably the two people who know the answer to this. I'm really ignorant about assessments, and I thought that some cities, while they only have to go on the property every 4 years and now it's 5, still annualize, though, projected increases extrapolating from other properties. I mean, aren't they moving them up yearly currently? Is that right?
That's my understanding, yeah, that they are. They, in talking to some, they might, you know, pick a number that hopefully is... I think there's a balancing act. If you get the values up too close to too high, then there's some contesting, so the number of people that come in and contest the assessment increases, so they try and I think when they're doing a mass increase like that across the entire taxing district, that it probably tends to be maybe below what the actual market might indicate. But yes, I think they do attempt to do that, at least in some areas. It does vary, though, across the state from what we've seen, too, from what I know about it. Now, assessing is its own area of expertise, and I'm not an expert in that. It's a little different than the kind of appraising that I do.
And
Ms. Baker?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lincheski, I think sometimes you hear the term blanket increases used, and I think that's kind of what they're referring to, is that they will kind of blanket increase all of a certain kind by 5% to kind of try and keep up with inflation or what's happening to the marketplace. And then they will, you know, go out and view and work on 20% or 25% or however they've divided up the city and the county and whatever. But I think they really do try and do some of this blanket increases, but that doesn't always work real well, because that doesn't mean that all property really should be going up by that.
Representative Broad?
I'll just quickly add, Karen actually just got to my point, is that the properties really are changing at different rates depending on the demand and the supply and all sorts of things that happen within a specific market. So even if you do a blanket increase, it's not going to be probably appropriate for every home. And some, you know, depending in my area, it's hard to find a house, an entry-level house. At $110,000, and those, because of the supply is short, the market is going up faster on some of those than the other homes. So.
Representative Lanning?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In response to Representative Lincheski's question, the state requires local assessors to track the sales in a given year, and if the sale price is less than 90% of what the assessors have had on the books, they're expected to adjust those property classifications accordingly. And so they may have to raise it 5-6%, whatever the case might be. And if the local Board of Equalization and local assessor do not do that, the state can come in and say, you shall raise your values by whatever percentage, because obviously the target here is for assessors to have it at 100% of market value, and there is some latitude, and certainly where local communities can have a problem is if it falls below 90%. And so there are automatic increases, even though assessors have a difficult time. Certainly when it was a four-year requirement, many assessors had a great deal of difficulty meeting that timetable, and I think even with five, that is a problem for many, but there is built into the system a way to correct that. And so even though a property hasn't been viewed, it might be brought up because of what's happening in that local marketplace.
Representative Lincheski, did you have any? Okay. Ms. Baker?
I think we are now going to turn it over to the commissioner.
Okay. Thank you. Commissioner, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dan Solomon, Commissioner of Revenue. I appreciate the assistance of House staff in providing some background on limited market value. I have a slide presentation that you have in your packet, and they touched on a lot of the introductory slides, so that will save me some time. Let me just start out by saying this is a difficult subject. As you heard, limited market value has been around a long time. You need to think as members what the goal of the limited market value program is and how well those goals are being met by the program. We have some concerns about it. I will also say that on March 1st, you will get a report from the department on limited market value, and its focus will be what's happened to valuations. So it will tell you in great detail by location in the state how much value has been withheld from taxation because of limited market value. My focus today, while I'll have a few points to make about that, my focus in this presentation is the tax implications of limited market value, not simply the valuation implications. We know, obviously, that limited market value takes value off the property tax rolls. And you need to understand that any time value is taken off the property tax rolls, taxes shift. Unless you're buying off the shift with state money or some other means to finance that. So I view limited market value and a whole host of other exclusions and limitations as nothing but classification in a disguised manner. It has the same effect as if you had enacted classification change. In the case of limited market value, the class would be the preferred classes that we said would be part of the program, residential property, farms and cabins, and timberland. We've said that those classes are going to get this preferential treatment. We could have done it, I suppose, by creating a class rate or a second-tier class rate, God forbid. But we didn't do that. We said we would limit valuations with a cap. But I want to make that point that the distribution of the tax base is what determines the share of the tax that's paid by each taxpayer.
And this changes
the distribution.
Mr. Salamone, isn't that based on the premise that all properties were accurately assessed?
Well, Mr. Chair, certainly to the extent that assessments are inaccurate, there is some de facto classification going on through the assessments. Minnesota does, I think, a pretty good job of policing against that. You know, we don't get it perfectly, obviously, but we have our sales ratio studies and our orders to get those values adjusted when we see that they're outside the acceptable range. We've looked at other states in the past when I was at the association as to how well they do that, and many of them have terrible inequities in their assessments. So they have classification maybe even to a greater extent than we do, but they have it out in the field rather than on the statute books where I think it belongs. So I think we're in pretty good shape relative to how well this can be done at the assessment level, but your point is certainly valid. Let me just walk you then very quickly through the slides and get to what will be a review of a study done by Matt Mossman, who used to be a House staff member and who we lost in the first week of session. So I'm going to present his study as best I can. And we've already talked to your staff about enlisting their support should I get trapped into things I don't understand in this topic, but generally understand what's happening. If you look at the first slide, of course, we talked about, you have the background on limited market value. We'll talk about the prevalence of it. You heard a little bit about that from Steve Hines. But we're going to focus on the parcel level effects for homeowners, cabin owners, and farms. If you go to the next slide, slide 2, second page, it shows you the properties covered by limited market value. That's already been talked about. Those are what we call the preferred classes, if you will. The terminology that you'll hear and have heard, preferred classes refers to those classes subject to the law, the limited market value law. Estimated market value is the assessor's estimate of full market value, so it's sort of what the assessor thinks the property's worth. We talk about captured value or limited value as the amount that's taken off the rolls from the limitation. Captured value is probably not the best phrase. It seems like it's uncaptured value, sort of unleashed value comes outside the system. I think it's been carried over from TIF, where it seemed to make a little more sense. And then we talk about taxable market value or limited value. This is the actual amount that's used in the tax calculation. It's the amount after the limitation has been applied. There's a nice summary table on the next page, slide number 4, that shows the phasing out of limited market value, both in terms of the threshold percentage and the what I might call the clawback percentage, the amount of value you're bringing back as you're phasing this out. And you'll see that the last year of the limited market value would be taxes payable in 2007. And in that last year, we're going to pull back 50% of the value that was 50% of the difference between the previous year's value and the current year value. And we'll also apply 15% cap on that value. But in that payable year 2008, we'd be without a limitation at all. So the remaining value comes on off the program, so to speak. You heard about the rich history of limited market value. And I think it's pretty clear what the goal was. The goal was to protect those preferred classes. Mr. Chair, I think you raised the question about why wasn't the early limited market value provision applied to all properties. And I think the answer maybe is that there was a concern about only certain properties, not all properties. So it was an attempt to provide a benefit deliberately to a subset of properties rather than to all properties.
Commissioner, I think the other issue, one of the other issues is that as a tax, the value doubling on your home, unlike the income tax, if your tax payable doubled, you'd have increased your income somewhat anyway. It may not have doubled, whereas with real estate, you know, with the homeowner's tax, their tax could double with no relation to their income or their ability to pay. And I think that's one reason that constituents get so irate, you know, as the values go up or when they get their tax bill now with this phase out, is, you know, how are they going to actually pay that? And so it's a little bit different than the income tax in that regard, and I think it's very unique in that particular with that outcome. So.
Mr. Chair, I agree with you about that. It makes the property tax much more undesirable, I guess, from the point of view of taxpayers. It is the most unpopular tax at the state level, and that's partly why they don't see it as being connected to ability to pay. One thing we do to try to make a connection is to have a pretty liberal circuit breaker so that when taxes are high relative to income, we kick in with a state payment, a co-payment, if you will. That's how we try to deal with that. One of the key misunderstandings of the property tax in the mind, I think, of the general public and even a fair number of reporters is that valuations somehow determine directly your tax amount. And the fact valuations are sort of like index numbers. They determine how you're going to distribute the levy. And if we were reckless and wanted to do a little experiment, we'd pass a bill that froze all values across the board for a year or two, and the lesson would be learned once and for all, because taxes would continue to rise with the levy. The only thing they're locking in is the share of the levy for 2 years that each taxpayer will pay.
That proposal's out there, Commissioner.
In some form or another, Mr. Chair, I understand that, but I did characterize it as a kind of reckless thing that one would do to make an education point. But it's frustrating to talk about valuations and have them be interpreted as having sort of the highest importance in determining the property tax levy. If we freeze all values today, all we'll do is increase tax rates according to what happens to the levy. I think that's really an important point to understand, and I think it'll help explain some of the mysteries of a limited market value as we go through this. As to policy, I mentioned, I speculated about what that early policy might have been. I think it's clear that what we're trying to do is shield certain parcels from rapid increases in market value. I suppose if we took a poll of members or the general public, we'd come up with 50 other goals that they ascribe to limited market value. But I think this is probably the one that is correct, and explains why we have done what we've done. Now we can shift into take a look at how prevalent is limited market value on slide number 8 is a graph similar to what Steve mentioned just at the tail end of his presentation, showing the total amount of captured value between 1995 and 2005. Our numbers are a little different, and I suspect there are little methodology differences that we can iron out. But the point, the pattern is the same. It's sort of gradual ramp up, a sudden increase starting in the early 2000, 2001, 2002, as the value started to grow rapidly for these protected classes. And then you see the beginning of the phase out sort of really having a bite, bringing down that value for 2005. This is the $33 million of captured value. The next slide shows the captured value as a percentage.
Excuse me, Commissioner. Representative Brad?
Actually, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I might be ahead of the Commissioner here. I'm sorry. See, maybe I'll wait. I think I'm on number 8. Are you still on number 8? Or are you jumping to 9? Okay, thank you, Commissioner. What does the rest of, if you were to project out from 2005 to 2010, what does that chart look like?
Those bars will continue to fall until we get to 2008, at which they will be non-existent because we will have gotten rid of the limited market value.
Like a plane crash.
So it's pretty even. Okay.
Right. I don't know. I suppose if you look at the pattern of the fallback percentages, we get up to 50% in 07. I think it's directly correlated with how fast we're pulling that value back into the system.
Okay.
But certainly that graph will continue to fall if we stay with the phase-out of the limited market value, which would be my personal preference. And the governor has not made a proposal to change the phase-out. That will just disappear. Graph 9 shows total captured value as a percentage of basically estimated market value. It's the value before the limitation. So it shows you, if you take the time to look at the legend, you'll see the blue line there is cabin property, and cabin property as of, and this is statewide, has the largest percentage of value excluded. The red line is farm property, which currently has the second highest amount of percentage of value excluded. You'll see the black X would be a statewide total, which is slightly higher than the amount excluded, percent excluded for residential property, which is the yellow line. I have the numbers that go along with these graphs. If you need those, you can get those too. Slide 10 shows the percent of the shares of captured value, metro and non-metro, by class of property for payable year 2005. For example, the The Metro bar shows that 90% of all the captured value is residential value. 10% of it is spread around as it was attributed to other classes of property. Obviously, we don't have as many farms, we don't have as many cabins, so this is going to be a relatively small share of the total captured value in the metro area. It's a residential phenomenon in the metro area. In non-metro,
Commissioner, could we go back just a minute to 9? And the reason... Now, this graph shows the seasonal rec as being the class of property that's most undervalued. Would that be accurate, or would it...
Mr. Chair, I would not use the term undervalued. That sort of makes me think of the original assessment of the property before the limitation. This simply shows that once you have that assessor's value, the estimated market value, what percentage of that, what is the captured value as a percentage of that original assessment? So if you look across, you'll see it's about 25%. So about a quarter, there's like a 25% discount off of the assessor's value as a result of limited market value.
That's excluded from the calculation of taxes.
Right.
About 25%. Okay. Thank you.
And to the point I made earlier was that that would be equivalent to providing a 25% discount to a classification rate. Apply to that particular class of property.
Representative Lanning.
Mr. Chair, to that point, wouldn't another way to explain this be that it indicates that values have increased more rapidly for seasonal recreational property overall?
That would explain why, because all the properties are subject to the same limitation formula, so you're right. You could make a direct correlation between the height of the graph and the increase in market value, market-driven increases. Back to slide 10, the non-metro, you can see the non-metro split on the captured value. It's primarily farm and timberland, which shouldn't be a surprise. 26% seasonal rec and 33% residential. So it shows you that it's much more of a mixed bag outside the metro area in terms of properties benefiting from the limitation. The slide on number 11 is similar to the one we just talked about. That was a statewide slide. This is a metro area slide. In the metro area, farms have the greatest growth, but remember, there aren't very many of them in the metro area, so that's not reflected in the graph. But you see the biggest beneficiaries being farms, followed by cabins, and then residential property, roughly almost comparable to the statewide average. Again, that's the entire metro area, so you don't see a lot of texture, sort of neighborhood effects that would be so important in the metro area. Slide 12, similar.
Chair. Representative Wickovina.
Chair, Commissioner, what's the history there, the explanation as to the flat line there until 2000 when you see the jump starting? Is it just it can't be the economy in those years, or maybe it can? Is it?
Mr. Chair, I think it's, Representative Wickovina, I think it's a reflection, and I always invite staff to correct me. I think it's a reflection of relatively smaller growth in those years. These were not years of real high growth in values. And also, I believe, years where the formula was not quite as rich as it is now.
But you don't see the same in the next graph. In the non-metro area, you see a slight decline, or a steady, although a slight increase, except for the cabins. There in the same, actually it's starting earlier, so I guess things were a little more valuable in rural.
Chair, Representative Rickovina, it's a percentage relationship, so you've sort of got things going on in both the numerator and the denominator here. So you have the amount of value that's being captured relative to the actual estimated market value, the assessor's value, which, so you have, it's hard to explain exactly why that number would be higher other than a larger numerator or a smaller denominator or some combination of both. maybe staff has a better way to explain that, but that's how I view it.
Commissioner, I just can't get off of slide 9 here. I'd like to go back. You know, there's some theories that there's what's called a politically vulnerable class of taxpayer in the property tax arena where could it be that the, again, we're looking at a system that had allowed a 10% increase each year annually, and the amount of property that, you know, that's not included in the tax base today is pretty substantial, meaning that the assessors either couldn't keep up or didn't keep up. But if you also were more aggressive on one class than another, couldn't that account for the higher amount of this 25% differential? Is that possible?
Mr. Chair, that's possible. I mean, certainly whatever the reason is for rapid growth in value would explain the location on this chart. Mm-hmm. I would say, though, that it would be incorrect to attribute to poor assessment the lion's share of the increase in value. It's just the fact that in some areas of the state, some properties' values have been growing very rapidly. And, in fact, it may be growing rapidly because the assessors are doing a good job of picking up that value growth, not necessarily because they're doing a bad job. I think assessor error would be a small percentage of the reason why these curves are rising.
So you're calling, Commissioner, what I call being more aggressive, you're calling that assessor error.
Mr. Chair,
which
I guess I would say aggressiveness on the part of an assessor would be to do being very aggressive in getting the value right. That's what we'd like to think they're doing, and that may be in many cases getting the value. It might result in a much higher value than if they were getting it wrong.
Maybe paying more attention to one class than another is.
Hopefully not, Mr. Chair. That's something we do police and look for biases by class and try to reverse those out through board orders.
Okay. Thank you. I think I'm done with slide 9.
Thomas, Mr. Chair. Where were we? I think we were about to go to the non-metro area slide. You now understand these slides, I hope. You can see that the seasonal rec has the greatest amount of percentage of value withheld. Although you begin to see now as we approach, as we work through the phase out, that is beginning to taper off. I'm not clear why the farm thing continues to rise. I suspect it's, again, the valuation limitation playing off against each other. That would explain that. I don't have a good answer for you there. So that's sort of some high-level review of the data just about the valuation limitation. And as I said earlier, the March report that we'll get to you on limited market will allow you to basically look up the data behind these graphs for just about every location in the state. So it's a very thick report that you can keep as a ready reference on your desk should anyone want to know what's happened to valuations in the state. What I want to do now with the next slide is transition into the tax effects of limited market value, which are much more interesting.
Before we do that, Commissioner, Representative Simpson had a question.
I was just going to comment on the seasonal rec properties and the rec properties. We're just seeing tremendous growth in our area on those. Now, is that because of the, when you show the drop-off, is that because of the drop-off of the rate, because we're still seeing the growth in the marketplace.
Mr. Chair, the tax rate wouldn't reflect anything on this graph. This is purely a value graph.
Okay.
It obviously represents the interplay between the growth in value and what's happening in the phase-out schedule.
Mm-hmm.
That would explain that. Now, I don't have that slide right in front of you. If you back earlier in the presentation, you have the table of phase out, and this, by the way, is for tax year payable year 2005. And for payable year 2005, you see that we moved from clawback of 20% to 25%, but the limitation went up from 12 to 15. But there's a lot going on here, and I suspect we'd have to look a little closer to find out exactly why that we're beginning to see that tail off. I suspect it's going from 20 to 25%, pulling back, you know, the change in value from the previous year. Mr. Chair, slide 13, we begin looking at the tax effects, and this is where Matt Mossman's detailed study comes into play, and I want to share with you what he found. The tax shift effects of LMV occur locally at the parcel level, so we tried to look at parcel level data. And the patterns obviously vary across the state depending on various market forces and the mix of properties. Anytime you're talking about class rate changes or valuation shifts, the mix of property, what percent is commercial versus residential, is a big factor in how much shifting goes on. The second bullet is really important to be clear on. The study that we're going to review here attempts to analyze how the elimination of limited market value, i.e. the phase-out, will affect individual parcels of property. I underline elimination because sometimes we slip into talking about the effect of limited market as opposed to the effect of repealing it. So we'll try to be clear on when. In fact, generally we'll be talking about effects of eliminating limited market. So we have to be careful about that. We asked three policy questions. How many parcels would pay more tax if we eliminate limited market value, and how many will pay less? How much more or less, and where are the parcels located? And I will provide you later some maps that you can, nice colored maps where you can see where the action is across the state. Those are the big questions. And in terms of methodology, we looked at parcel level data from 2005. We have a lot of property tax data, obviously. We looked at specifically at residential homesteads, at cabins, and for those two categories, we covered almost 100% of the parcels in the study. We looked at farm homesteads, and we covered about 50% of those farmsteads. Farm homesteads.
Excuse me, Commissioner, Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, looking at slide 14 where you identify three key questions, I think that there are a couple of other questions that are also critical here that I was going to save until we got more into the seasonal recreational property, but let me bring them up here. Philosophically, I understand and appreciate the elimination of the limited market value. I understand the reasons for it. I appreciate those. But I think we need to take a look at what the real implications, practical implications, are going to be, particularly for seasonal rec. Now, I come from a community, there are many communities where the phase-out of limited market value is not going to have a lot of effect on residential because our residential property values are only modestly increasing, not dramatically. But in the case of seasonal rec, we're already seeing a couple things happen. One is that people are selling their homes, their homesteaded property, and transferring their homestead to seasonal, and then they're spending the rest of their year elsewhere. That's happening. We're losing residents over this. Another issue that's happening is that people are transferring their homestead to their seasonal rec. And that's got implications for local communities as well as for the communities to which they're transferring their homestead. And so I'm suggesting that there are a couple of other important questions here as to what are the practical implications of this change in policy in terms of where people choose to live, in terms of where people choose to place their homestead. And I don't know that we have examine those questions like we need to. And I know from my perspective in my district, both of these questions are real important. So I don't know what your response might be, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, I don't disagree that there will be implications, and we'll show you some of them, of following through with the repeal of limited market value. I would add a few other questions to your list, and those certainly are good ones. And I think if the decision is made to continue the phase out of limited market value or not to, or to change it, we need to talk about the kinds of questions that you've raised. I would add a question of, when we talk about who's paying more and who's paying less, you know, who's subsidizing whom? So what is the cost of dealing with the problem you're talking about? We have to confront that at some point. We know all too well that there are no free lunches in the world. The older I get, the more I understand that. And what we'll do is talk about the sort of macro shifting. But your questions are appropriate. They're just, at this point, a little more detailed than what we had initially put into this presentation, or the study, I should say. When you get around to debating what to do about limited market value, those are the kinds of things you're going to have to talk about. And it's not just a cabin issue. There are other issues with other classes of property.
Well, Commissioner, when you talk about shifts, you know, some people, including myself, will argue that the shift is actually onto the most recently valued property. I think Representative Abrams had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, isn't the real problem, the real tax policy problem with limited market value and classifications, is that we don't have a house as a house in Minnesota? So some of the questions that Representative Lanning has raised is because we have a separate classification for cabins, subject to a small statewide tax, and that if you just eliminated the classification entirely, somehow made up the money that the general fund would lose, and then provide the relief directly to the taxpayer rather than through the jurisdiction, either through a property tax refund program or a direct statement market value credit or some check that would be sent out directly from the Department of Revenue, you would eliminate a good portion of the decisional elements that Representative Lanning has basically outlined.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abrams, I agree with you on that. In fact, the phenomenon of homesteads being converted or selling, being sold in order to make the cabin the homestead, that would go away with. There'd be no motivation to do that if you had a single class system. It's a complicated system we have, a lot of interactions, and that's what makes this so challenging.
Hey, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Abrams.
It's very easy to talk about it theoretically, but the dollars that are necessary to get there without some shifts make it a pretty difficult thing to do. But if you're, in my judgment, if you're looking at where the policy ought to go, it ought to be a house is a house, and the relief ought to go directly to the taxpayer and be gone with the statewide tax, et cetera, and then your constituents, Representative Lanning, can decide where they want to live rather than their accountant.
I think the commissioner is there. It's the part of the problem again is the volatility of the tax, and without any limits on the increase. As you look through, is there any leveling or that you think would be good policy just to deal with the volatility? I mean, if somebody's taxes go up 10%, that's probably not going to put them under, but when they double, or they could conceivably triple, you know, without any limits at all, do you see anything as any type of mechanism as valid, or would you think it all be kind of bad policy?
Mr. Chair, this is a tough one. First of all, the tax itself is not volatile. I don't think you meant to refer to the tax so much as a tax on an individual parcel or person.
Correct.
The levies clearly are very stable just because of the mathematics of the property tax. So putting aside the levy, or taking a levy as a given, anything you do, as I said earlier, is going to shift taxes. So if you want to help those who have rapidly growing property taxes and you want to give them some sort of break, you either pay for it directly with a state appropriation, or you do the limitation thing, and it causes everyone else in the jurisdiction to ante up the money to pay for the subsidy. And that's where we get into difficulties with this. Now, the alternative, and as I suggested earlier, the way out of the box is to have a powerful circuit breaker that delivers the aid directly to the taxpayers that need it based on their income and their property tax bill. And we have that program. Unfortunately, none of these things, whatever we might cook up, will really solve the problem of cabin owners being upset about their rapidly growing valuations. It's a tax on value, and therefore, if you have more value, you're going to pay more tax, and that's the sort of hard thing to get away from with the property tax.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Salamone, are cabin owners who are not homesteaded, they are not eligible for the current circuit breaker. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Representative Broad, repeat that.
Are non-homesteaded properties like cabins, if they're a second property, eligible for the circuit breaker?
I believe that's correct.
Okay.
Heads are nodding in the right direction.
Commissioner.
So we maybe back to slide 14. That's certainly not a complete set of policy questions, Representative Lanning. It's the question that we addressed in the study that I'm presenting. With regard again to the methodology, we looked at taxes payable in 05 based on the truth in taxation levies that we now have for payable 05. It'll be a while before we know the final levies. The results are sorted by city and town level, so we have a lot of detail. As I said, we'll give you some maps here in a little while. If you go to slide 16, this is probably a very high-level summary of the study. In terms of what does it do to tax liabilities, this is a statewide bar chart. Well, I'm sorry, it's broken down to metro and non-metro. So if you look at the metro block, it says that the biggest winner in terms of reductions in tax, average percent reduction in tax, in the metro area are farms, and that's consistent with the graph we saw, followed by timberland in from left to right, and then the cabins, the yellow bar showing the cabin reduction, relatively small percentage reductions in residential property in the metro area because of limited market value, and then the blue block is non-homesteaded property. And then if you shift to the positive blocks, you see the purple is apartment property gaining from limited market value. I'm sorry, percent increase, losing from limited market value. Commercial industrial loses from limited market value. And seasonal commercial property resorts also lose as a result of limited market value. So you have the preferential properties winning, the non-preferential properties losing. So you're having a shift of tax from the rapidly growing protected classes to the other classes, which could be rapidly growing, but they're not protected in the limited market value program. So they're paying the part of the tab for the reductions that are shown there. Similar pattern in the non-metro, different magnitudes. The striking difference is that residential property actually has a net increase in rural Minnesota as a result of limited market value. As a class, they're paying more as a result of the program. And again, the commercial, industrial, apartments, and resorts are paying more.
So, Commissioner, would, if they had been included in the LMV, would those classes that you're referring to, would that have made any difference?
Mr. Chair, as we'll see as we get through the further into the presentation, if we had put all classes into the limitation, you would still have winners and losers to the extent that you have differential rates of growth, or more accurately, differential rates of exclusion from the limitation. So you can't escape having losers when you limit valuations, unless, Mr. Chair, you limit everyone's property by the very same percentage. And you remove value proportionately for every class of property, which of course would be meaningless to do because it would simply cause the tax rate to go up in the opposite direction and everyone would pay the same tax they did before. So it doesn't make sense to limit property unless you do it disproportionately. And when you do it disproportionately, somebody pays.
Just like that game I saw at the bar where you hit the one thing, it goes down and another one comes up.
That's exactly right, Mr. Chair.
Representative Simpson.
Thank you. Commissioner, one of the other issues that I'm hearing in rural Minnesota, rural
real often, and we're talking policy changes, as we see our farm, the base for our farm tax going up, valuations are increasing rapidly, and they're being driven basically by seasonal recreational land. We're finding a lot of people are coming out the rural area, out of the metro area, and buying acreage for hunting purposes. How can we look at that policy and try and stop the rapid growth in the farm valuations because of the seasonal stuff? Is there any thoughts there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simpson, I know we have a number of programs on the books, and I don't know if I can tick them all off, but I believe there is a special valuation procedure for farms in terms of, you know, being assessed as a farm rather than in the highest and best use. I believe there's a provision where they, Karen can maybe come up with the, what we call it, the, is it open spaces or?
Ms. Baker.
Chair, are you talking about the open space?
Well,
I think what Representative Simpson is talking about is just an individual deciding that he wants to go out and buy 40 acres of land to hunt on, and that 40 acres is really valued as farm, but once it changes into a hunting use, it really becomes more valuable than forage production, which was pasture. And that is causing all sorts of issues of driving values up. And the separation between that land and agricultural land isn't a very clear distinction. And I think that's what we're
Thank you. Thinking. You're absolutely correct. That's the issue. That's the issue.
Yes. Mr. Chair, John Hagen from our property tax division maybe can add some more to this.
Mr. Chair, John Hagen, Department of Revenue. As I understood the question, that the demand for hunting lands, rural lands, is driving the valuation of farmlands. We do have, which we see much more commonplace across the state, something called a green acres classification that takes into account and provides for external economic factors that cause the land to inflate more rapidly than the farmland values inflating. And that does help to mitigate that problem, but it certainly is a problem.
Mr. Chair, I think that's definitely a helper there, but I don't think it's working in all our counties, because we've got some counties that, for example, aren't doing true county assessing, and so we're finding some real challenges in the way they're valuing this stuff. So if we're looking at policy and looking at making changes, I think this is something that also needs to be really weighed out. So.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, one thing we within the Department of Revenue have really been focusing on is encouraging is perhaps the wrong word, but requiring counties to embrace the green acres classification, which some counties insist they do not have that issue in their county, that farmland sells for farmland. And we've spoken to experts from the University of Minnesota who maintain nowhere in the state does farmland sell as farmland, because there's other external characteristics that drive up the value. So what we're trying to do to deal with the problem is we're really encouraging, and maybe that's not a strong enough word, county assessors to embrace the green acres concept, which once that's done should resolve the problem.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And one quick question of clarification for Commissioner Salamone, and then a comment and question. Maybe I'm the only one who didn't have that clear, but did you say seasonal rec were allowed to take the circuit breaker or not?
No.
Okay, they are not. Okay, I didn't know for sure. Thank you. One other, I guess, comment on this, and maybe another option. You know, in the short period I've been on the tax committee, you hear constantly about the inequities. I don't know if we'd ever be able to eliminate the inequities in all this system. And maybe going to another little different issue on just talking about, now that the governor's looking at a turbocharged situation at the kind of the end of the process, you know, I think we have to make the property tax process as simple as possible, and you do that by removing as many movable parts as you can. And in short, how much you're going to pay in taxes based on your adjusted net tax capacity times the tax rate. And so when the property taxpayer gets this bill at the end and they get a number and it's gone up 10-15%, was it your market value that went up? Was it the tax rate? And now when you get to the turbocharge, you're going to be having people decide to put a yes or a no with all these factors. And let me just throw out one that I know has probably been discussed before, and in fact, Commissioner Salamone, you alluded to a little bit. What about just freezing market values for 10 years? You put them in there. Now, it's freeze it. You could reassess every 10 years. That way, if your property taxes are going up, it's only because of the tax rate. So you can't have even a local unit of jurisdiction say, you know, we froze the tax rate for the fifth year in a row, and yet the market values are skyrocketing. And, you know, when you get the seasonal rec land, what we see is that a lot of people from outside the area who have a lot more income than I do can pay exorbitant amounts for these pieces of land. And when assessors go out, they'll look at sales ratios, and pretty much that's it. But they don't ever take into consideration the value or the incomes of people around these lands or other factors that can influence things. Because for the senior citizen who doesn't plan on selling their home, or someone on seasonal rec who doesn't plan on selling that, that sale that happened down the road doesn't make any difference at all to them. And, you know, I know in the city of Dilworth, I was kind of crazy, but what I would do, what I did a couple years, is I literally went into our books between two different payable years for taxes, and I would open up that property tax book, and I'd go to the top property on each line, and then I'd compare it with the same. And I did that, and even in a small city like Dilworth, we had like 15 different subdivisions. And then I calculated, I took a random sample, and every subdivision was different on the amount that the assessments went up. So it creates so much inequity between taxpayers. When you were a city council member, you tried to set a levy and tried to determine what impact that was going to have on a homeowner. There was absolutely no, well, where do you live? You know, and I'm sure most people didn't actually compare things to see how that affected each area of the city. And I know it might not be taken seriously, but I do believe it would be very workable just to freeze things for 10 years. Everyone would know what it's all about for 10 years. You could come back and reassess it. Might really shake things up. You could have a circuit breaker in so nothing would increase more than on a certain percent. But then all this going up and down and the ebb and flow and the unpredictability and unaccountability would be eliminated out of the system. And the seasonal rec is huge, and I don't see under the current system how we solve this problem other than something a little different than thinking out of the box, because, or even looking at more than just sales ratios for sales and looking at the area around it or whatever. But it, like Representative Lanning and Simpson has stated, it is a huge, huge problem. But throw that out there. But thank you.
Commissioner, did you want to endorse Representative Marquardt's freeze?
Wait, Commissioner, so Mr. Chair?
Yep.
Commissioner Solomon, we could call it a turbocharged limited market value, is what we said if you would.
Mr. Chair, I certainly don't want to endorse anything today. I'll only say that if your goal is to freeze the tax, you know that won't freeze the tax.
No.
And so what you are freezing are the shares of the tax. So if we put this in place this year for 10 years forward, whatever the share of my local tax is going to be constant year after year. Now, a year after that, my neighbor could put on a very expensive addition, or maybe even literally tear down most of the house and rebuild it and make it worth several times more. They'll pay the same share as they did before. So there will quickly be tremendous inequities, if you care about inequities in terms of horizontal equity, if people with the same valued property pay the same tax. You're providing a new definition of horizontal equity, which is people pay the same share of the levy as they did in past years, at least for a 10-year period. And I think you really ought to debate that quite a bit, because that's quite a change.
Representative Mark Clark. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple quick comments. We can hopefully maybe talk about this another day. But, no, certainly you would account for new construction and improvements. That certainly would change that. But and granted, the tax rate would go up, but at least as a property owner now, you would know that if your property, especially if we are seriously looking at a turbocharged system at the end, you've removed the movable part. And now, if my value's gone up, unless I put on a new addition to my home, I know it's because the tax rate has gone up and no other factor for the most part. So I do think the simpler we make the system, the more understandable and you know, people, if they have an understanding of something, is going to at least know what's going on. So, thank you.
Okay. Commissioner.
I want to move us to the next slide, 17, which, if I was told I could only have one slide for this presentation, this would be the slide, and I want to spend a considerable amount of time on it. This showed the tax effects within the residential class for taxes payable 05. We'll look at a similar chart with regard to cabins. This says, what would happen if you eliminated limited market value? And what we did was run the model by basically putting in the value that had been captured, putting that value back in, recalculating tax rates, and basically looking at the effects parcel by parcel. And I think the findings are stunning and not surprising if you think about the implications of this limitation. It shows that 440,000 homeowners would pay $101 million more in tax if we eliminate limited market value immediately. Now, they'll pay that over the rest of the phase-out, the way things are set up right now. That's 32% of homeowners will pay more without the provision. 950,000 homeowners, 68%, nearly 70% of homeowners would pay $95 million less in tax. That getting rid of limited market value will lower the property tax for over nearly 70% of the homestead properties. And what is really stunning and difficult to explain is that 27% of those homeowners who are getting a reduction in tax from the limitation phase out, 27% of them, 260,000 of them, will have some value withheld. So we have 260,000 homesteads that are having limited valuations and paying more tax because of it right now. And they would pay less if we got rid of the program. And that goes to my point about proportional changes in the tax base. They have a limitation, but proportionally it's not as big as the limitation of other homestead property. And that's what's happening here. There's also a shift between homesteads and other properties. That's a $6 million shift off of other classes like commercial, industrial, apartments, and so on. That's really an important slide, Mr. Chair. The key message, I think, of this presentation, if there's one, is that limited market value is not good for every property that's limited. Certainly not good for every homestead. We see that the majority of homesteads paying actually under the current limitation more tax than they would if we got rid of it. And I think that presents a real policy dilemma for us.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, do you have a slide like this, broken down metro and non-metro?
Mr. Chair, I don't think, not in this presentation. We might be able to get it for you.
I would like to see that slide broken down metro and non-metro. Thank you.
Representative Lynch.
Thank you, Chairman Van De Veer and Commissioner Salamone. Can you just, I guess, conjecture here? I have always thought the same thing that you are just stating now, is that what people don't understand about LMV is most people would do better if it went away. However, those most people change yearly as to who they are, depending what chunk of the market. If, as Representative Broad stated earlier, if you're in a community that the hot properties are starter homes and you're in that class, you're being captured and you're able to shift your tax burden to somebody else in your own community. And if you're at a certain time there's a high-valued home, say, they're in your own community. And they're really the hot property and they're really moving in value, you're able to shift your, quite frankly, tax responsibility to somebody in a low-value home. And so it's always a moving target given the market. And I think part of the problem with this is we want to fix everything, but you know, it's the market. I mean, these are investments in the markets, and markets move, and markets generally work, and we're trying to mess with the market. But can you say over time, just in a really general way, which sorts of homes are generally being helped and hit, or is it a complete wash that it's... I think a lot of people have the stereotype in their mind that the people who get protected by LMB tend to be the wealthy homeowners. And I have found, trying to figure it out, that some years it's the most modest homes that are getting a lot of protection. Some years it's the really wealthy homes, and it varies metro and non. And I mean, is there a way to try to figure out for those who would like to keep this program? And I'm not one of them. I'd like to see LMB phased out, and then a circuit breaker is the way to go. But if you wanted to keep that going, how would you ever know who you're really subsidizing and who's getting the preferential treatment when? How do you track that? Because we all represent cities that are doing it on their own. It's a difficult thing to comprehend.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lincheski, I understand your frustration. I have the same thing with this problem. In order to do what you're trying to get at, to be able to say, okay, the people who are paying less are people who really need a break based on their income, we'd have to do a research project just to try to match up incomes with values, and that's very difficult. You're familiar, I think, with the VOS data, that database that we had in the past, and maybe someday we'll take a crack at updating that and having something where we can do that. But even if we could do it, it would be a research project every year to identify those people. The only generalization I can make and you can make is that with this program, the beneficiaries are people who have the fastest growing properties, and the losers are those with the least growing properties. Then you have to ask yourself, of the people who have the fastest growing properties, the winners, are they low income people or high income people? What do we know? Well, there's no reason to think they have any particular income level. They just happen to have property that is for some reason very hot in the marketplace. And they could be inner city families living in areas that are being regentrified, and suddenly you're having huge increases in the value, or speculative increases maybe. They could be high income people living, the losers could be high income people living in areas that have gone flat. There are huge policy questions and need to have that kind of information, but it's so difficult to get at this point.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, I'll just recap this slide again because I think it's a really important point. That the homesteads that we talk about in this slide, 950,000, pay $95 million more in tax under current law and would pay less under the elimination of the limited market. They're paying $95 million of the $101 million that benefit that goes to the beneficiaries of the program. And so that you have this huge cross-subsidy between homesteads that, as Representative Lincheski points out, it'd be nice if we knew a lot more about these people, but we don't. The next slide, just give you a little more detail on this. There's a bar chart showing the average change in tax for homesteads starting in the middle at no change. You'll see a zero in the middle of the axis there, and then if you move from that to the left, you'll see that you have some pretty big bars. The highest bar is $342,000. The next bar over is $260,000, $241,000. Those are the numbers of homesteads. This shows the average tax change, not the percent increase. So it shows the average tax change is $100 for the 950,000 homesteads. The median is $72, and it shows the frequency by size of change as you go in either direction from zero. For the 440 homesteads that are currently beneficiaries and would pay more if we took away limited market value, the average is right at about $229. Median value is $135. The chart right below it is the same information, not in terms of average tax change, but in terms of percentage change in tax. You can see that the lion's share of homeowners, $550,000, would be having a reduction in tax from the elimination, of a reduction of 5% or less. On the other side of the chart, you see 440,000 homesteads paying more. 138,000 would pay 5% more, 86,000 from 5 to 10% more. So there's a lot of detail here, and I think Representative Lanning is asking for this kind of information, sort of metro, non-metro, and we'll hopefully get that for you. There are some maps I will give you. I think because there's only three slides, let me finish those, and then we'll get the maps distributed. And maybe Paige could get these out. skipping over the maps, we can talk about the effect on cabins, much like we just did with the homesteads. Numbers obviously are different. In the case of the cabins, elimination of limited market value would cause 154,000 cabin parcels to pay $33 million more in tax. So clearly cabin owners are winning, but not all cabin owners. There are 42,000 cabin owners statewide that would pay $2.6 million less. So they're a part of the group that is subsidizing their cabin, other cabin owners. A lion's share of the subsidy for the cabin owners is coming from non-cabin property. $30 million will be coming basically as a result of commercial property paying more apartments and other non-cabin property. The last two slides are identical to the ones we just looked at for residential property, showing the average, the frequency distribution for average change in cabins and also the percent change. And if you want the actual numbers for the bars, that we can provide those. My last slide is a thank you, Mr. Chair, for having a chance to share this information with you.
Well, does anyone have any questions for the commissioner? Well, they sent the right person. You certainly know the topic, and I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I do need to explain the maps. Just so you know what you have.
Certainly.
I certainly don't want to go into any detail.
Go ahead.
You have three maps. The first one shows the, by a range of percent decrease in tax, the darkest green shows the biggest percent decreases in tax because of limited market value. The red shows the smallest percentage increases in tax. And it's just presented this way. If you want to talk about, well, what about the increases, you just take the complement of those numbers in the legend, and it'll tell you where the increases are, at least the percentages. The next two graphs show separately the percent tax change for the properties that are paying more because of limited market value elimination, and the parcels on the final graph show those that are paying the same or less as a result of eliminating the program. So if you care about the distributional effects, you've got to get your magnifier out and take a look at this map.
Maybe that answers Representative Lanning's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Nelson, would you move the minutes of the February 3rd meeting?
Mr. Chair,
any deletions or corrections to the minutes? All in favor of Representative Nelson's motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are adopted. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, I just meant to also say that the maps are showing payable year 04. We have not had a chance to update those to payable year 05. Slide presentation was about payable year 05. The maps are payable year 04. I don't expect you'd see a huge change, although obviously because of the phase-out, it would look differently. We'll see if that can be done.
I had already noticed some variation there.
You're pretty sharp, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I think we'll carry over the presentation on market value credit till to another meeting. And with that, we'll adjourn.